that fund concerts, film festivals, art shows, and other wellsprings of culture. A search for race, gender, or diversity on the website of Grantmakers in the Arts, the umbrella group for private arts funding organizations in the US, returns opportunities that look like salon articles. The kids and teens who idolize left-wing pop stars, watch movies made by left-wing film directors, and laugh at the jokes of left-wing comedians grow up to be, surprise, surprise, left-wing voters. This cannot continue. I'm suddenly aware this may come across as an argument for the obsessive representation of all kinds on screen, but it isn't. You see, black kids and lesbian kids and disabled kids don't need to see themselves on screen so much as they need to be exposed to a wide variety of ideas. Diversity of skin color is nothing compared to diversity of opinion. And the idea that people can't identify with movie or video game characters because they don't have the same race or gender is a ludicrous invention of the progressive left. When I was a kid, I identified with the vulnerability and gravity of Buffy Summers from Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Captain Janeway from Star Trek Voyager, despite the fact that I have a wonderful penis. Come off it. Conservatives need to realize they will continue to be beaten by the left if they keep ignoring the importance of culture. They need to spend less time obsessing over marginal tax rates and more time on the National Endowment for the Arts. Only then will the left-wing stranglehold on culture be beaten. Maybe the NEA shouldn't be disbanded completely, as some conservatives, including Daddy, have suggested. During World War II, Allied forces set up a unit of 400 service members and civilians to find and safeguard European art as their enemies fought their way across the continent. Victory would be meaningless if the very heritage of Western civilization was lost. As Ronald Reagan put it, "The arts and humanities teach us who we are and what we can be. They lie at the very core of the culture of which we're a part." He also said, "Where there's liberty, art succeeds." The NEA should focus on supporting great American artists, not meeting diversity quotas and pandering to progressives. And if that can't realistically be done, given the political biases of the art world, then yeah, I suppose Daddy's right. Just get rid of it for a while. Over the past decade, political correctness in culture has grown to the point where even left-wing creatives are feeling its stifling effect on free expression. Liberal comedians like Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld now refuse to perform for college audiences, who they say have become too sensitive for comedy routines, even though they aren't remotely right-wing. If conservatives make a serious effort to get back into the culture wars, they will find no shortage of grateful artists and creators eager to throw off the shackles of political correctness. On the other hand, of course, political correctness isn't just confined to the left. Let me explain. I am an ardent Zionist, and it isn't just because I have a thing for tanned, muscular IDF men with big guns. I'm ethnically Jewish on my mother's side, and in my younger days, I could be spotted on the BBC wearing a full-on Jewfro. Another thing I ardently support is free speech and the freedom to tell jokes. But some of my peers on the conservative right don't feel the same way. I was baffled when in 2016 conservative commentators suddenly became preoccupied with the threat to Jewish communities from internet nobodies posting offensive memes on social media. Many of these people identify as the alt-right, or at least the alt-right's shit-posting memester battalions. You see, to them, breaking taboos isn't about advancing white nationalist ideology. It's about gleefully watching outraged reactions from their elders. Jewish advocacy organizations, ginned up by the likes of National Review, The Daily Beast, and eventually the Clinton campaign, went so far as to declare a sort of war on memes. I'm not joking. 2 months before the election, the Anti-Defamation League, a venerable, respected name in the fight against anti-Semitism, nearly torpedoed their credibility forever by declaring Pepe the Frog a hate symbol. I'm not going to make lavish excuses for actually anti-Semitic memes, particularly when they come from genuine neo-Nazis. These sad specimens, consigned to a few irrelevant blogs like the Daily Stormer, declared a holy crusade against me in late 2016, after all. But unlike the ADL, I find this laughable rather than threatening. I don't have anything to fear from these people, and especially not from the Daily Stormer's editor, Andrew Anglin, who I'm told stands a mere 5'2" tall. There's a great picture, by the way, that does the rounds now and again of Anglin in Thailand with a few ladyboy hookers. And I also hear he's actually Jewish. I mean, this is the laughable leader of white power online. I will, however, defend anyone's right to speak and post freely on the internet without the threat of being banned. The best antidote to pathetic hatred is to defeat it publicly, not push it into the shadows where it will fester and grow. This is something that leftists and a worrying number of establishment conservatives simply don't understand. They worry that the more people see neo-Nazis, the more they'll be persuaded. Well, I have a sunnier view of human nature and of human reason. I have no argument with those who want to condemn the Daily Stormer and its ilk, but I do have an argument with those who lump everyone together who uses offensive memes with genuine neo-Nazis as part of the same basket of deplorables. As Alan Bakari and I highlighted in our article about the alt-right, many of the people using offensive memes aren't real Nazis at all, but just provocateurs and trolls and teenagers. They don't want to destroy multicultural societies or restore racial hierarchies. They just want to raise hell. Here's what we wrote at the time. Quote, "Just as the kids of the 60s shock their parents with promiscuity, long hair, and rock and roll, so too do the alt-right's young meme brigades shock older generations with outrageous caricatures, from the Jewish Shlomo Shekelberg to Remove Kebab, an internet joke about the Bosnian genocide. These caricatures are often spliced together with millennial pop culture references, from old 4chan memes like Pepe the Frog to anime and My Little Pony references. Are they actually bigots? No more than death metal devotees in the 80s were actually Satanists. For them, it's just a means to fluster their grandparents. Currently, the grandfather-in-chief is Republican consultant Rick Wilson, who attracted the attention of this group on Twitter after attacking them as, quote, childish single men who jerk off to anime, end quote. Responding in kind, they proceeded to unleash all the weapons of mass trolling that anonymous subcultures are notorious for and brilliant at, from digging up the most embarrassing parts of his family's internet history to ordering unwanted pizzas to his house and bombarding his feed with anime and Nazi propaganda. The alt-right's meme team, in typically juvenile but undeniably hysterical fashion, revealed their true motivations, which are not racism, the restoration of monarchy or traditional gender roles, but lulls. End quote. Even I will admit these kids do sometimes go too far, and not all the taboos they want to break are in need of breaking. There's a reason why anti-Semitism and racism are not acceptable, and never should be. But the response of the establishment right, unnervingly familiar in tone to the career-destroying mobs of social justice warriors, is worse. These are kids. They don't deserve to have their lives and careers destroyed because they posted dangerous memes or flirted with dangerous ideas on the internet. It doesn't do these young people justice to simply rebut the establishment's misguided allegations of retrograde racism. These people aren't just not racists, they're also among the best and brightest of their generation. They're talented, creative, and funny. No one's life is ruined by bitchy messages on a computer screen. Get a grip, snowflakes, left and right. It's words on a computer screen. You can't deliberately ignore context. You can't treat a harmless hellraiser from 4chan as no different from a Daily Stormer Nazi without pausing to examine the motives and values of the individual. Like the left's political correctness, the right's political correctness is collectivist and reductive in its logic. It will destroy the lives of innocent people if it goes unchecked, and we must fight against it until it dies. The cause of Israel is not helped by hysterical conservatives and mainstream media outlets comparing the slogan America First to Charles Lindbergh-style isolationism. Nor is the fight against anti-Semitism helped by people like Bill Kristol playing into Daily Stormer talking points by suggesting that America's white working class should be replaced by immigrants. I'm a staunch defender of Israel and an opponent of anti-Semitism, and I have no doubt Kristol is too, but unlike him, I'm not making things worse. There's something noble about trying to preserve the standards of decorum that existed prior to the 1960s, when a single swear word on TV could lead to a boycott campaign. But that worldview is completely understandable for conservatives and perhaps even most liberals over 65. But if you're under 40, it's likely you fall into the unfortunate, slightly laughable group I call debate club conservatives, and it's time to snap out of all of that. If you don't have the stomach to do what it takes to win, chances are you're going to lose. And that's exactly what debate club conservatives did when faced with Donald Trump. Again and again, the Republican candidates tried to convince their base that we shouldn't vote for Trump because, well, he's just so unkind and uncouth and indecorous. Well, again and again, voters didn't listen to this sort of stuff. Ted Cruz said Trump was a pathological liar, a bully, and a narcissist. Jeb Bush called him a buffoon, a clown, and an asshole. Well, Republicans voted for that asshole. John Kasich, long after his inevitable primary defeat, said, "I will not vote for a nominee that has behaved in a manner that reflects so poorly on our country. Our country deserves better." Well, Republicans didn't think so. The American conservatives lament that graceful, dignified Jeb Bush had been beaten by the tactics of a man who, quote, lacks character, sums up the attitude of debate club conservatives to elections and to contests in general. They think it's better to lose with dignity than to win without it. I disagree. In the Republican primaries, they mostly got their wish, although Jeb Bush's entreaties for audiences to please clap for him were anything but dignified. The Conservative sense of fair play is disastrous when it comes to fighting Democrats. Elections are not college debates, no matter how much Ted Cruz might wish that that was so. They're not fought with facts and opinions, but with sloganeering, media spin, opposition research, and cloak and dagger tactics. In politics, victory goes to those with cunning, mettle, and deviousness, not to those who only have facts and principles on their side, although, of course, you do need those things too, and Conservatives usually have both. There's another reason why the debate club conservative attitude is so damaging to the conservative movement. Most people are not political obsessives. They don't care about your 14-point refutation of Obamacare. They want to hear things that relate to their own experiences and not abstract policy debates. They care about love, sex, death, money, things that affect them every day. One comment from Ben Shapiro made on the Rubin Report in February 2016 sums up this conservative myopia. He said, quote, "The problem with Trump is he fails to distinguish political incorrectness from just being a jackass. There's a difference between being rude and being politically incorrect. Being rude is telling Megyn Kelly she's bleeding from her wherever. Being politically incorrect is saying some immigrants coming across our southern border are criminals. That's politically incorrect, but not rude," end quote. Shapiro's thinking of a world where only politics matter. To him, political correctness is a problem because it suppresses facts relevant to current affairs, and that's it. But for most other people, the stultifying rules of political correctness go far beyond the suppression of facts. It's the suppression of jokes, banter, and yes, the suppression of rudeness. Rudeness is really important. Political correctness interrupts everyday human experiences, threatening to turn every single personal matter into a public one. You can no longer slip up in conversation without worrying if the person you're talking to is going to tell the whole world what you said, potentially ruining your life forever. I don't need to provide you with a personal example. The internet's erosion of privacy with the resurgence of politically correct taboos is a terrifying combination, and that's why so many people were drawn to Trump. Debate club conservatives don't understand any of this because they think politics is a debate club. In their imagined political ideal, elections are fought issue by issue, with each candidate presenting his arguments on foreign and domestic policy in neat little 30-minute segments. But in reality, politics doesn't work like that, and if it did, voter turnout would be even worse. There's perhaps no better example of debate club conservatives being outplayed by the aggressive hellraisers than the replacement of Megyn Kelly, formerly the face of Fox News, with Tucker Carlson. Kelly, now tanking at NBC, is a milquetoast moderate conservative who, during the election campaign, attracted attention for playing the resident feminist, going after Donald Trump for making demeaning comments about women. Carlson, on the other hand, is a warrior of the airwaves who lives to skewer progressives in front of a national audience. In his first week, Carlson almost doubled Kelly's ratings, including a 45% increase in the all-important 25 to 54 age demographic. His show is great, and that's why he got Bill O'Reilly's job. Fox News has provided the roadmap for conservative media organizations seeking to rescue themselves from decline. Bring in someone who isn't a total cuck. Politics isn't won just by commanding the facts, although you need the facts too. It's won by connecting with people's experiences. That's why it's so important for conservatives to re-engage with culture and entertainment, which are the commanding heights of people's experiences in the modern world. All our brilliant political victories will come to an end if we don't win the culture war. The fact that Donald Trump's signature election promise, ending immigration laws, was seen as so controversial is a testament to how well progressives have ingrained their views on our culture. As recently as the 1990s, such a suggestion was completely mainstream. This is how progressives keep managing to win the battle for America's soul, despite occasional temporary setbacks on election day. And that's why, in a society increasingly frustrated by political correctness, conservatives need to grit their teeth and come to terms with the necessity of gauche, bragging provocateurs like Donald Trump and me. I'll be the first to admit that we do need debate club conservatives. It's immensely valuable to have people who can utterly dominate the left in an argument. Just compare the power and rigor of a George Will column with one by Jessica Valenti. The strongest mind on the left today is probably Slavoj Žižek, and he supported Trump over Clinton. When the public ignores the left's entreaties not to watch or read or listen to conservatives because of bigotry, they are often swayed by our arguments. But arguments aren't enough. We can't let the left continue to dominate culture, entertainment, and the norms of everyday language itself and expect to win elections. We can't hope that every member of the public will see through the left's lies and eventually discover George Will and the Washington Post just on their own. Most of conservatism is kept hidden from the public, especially in schools and colleges, where young people are just figuring out who they are and what their principles might be. As Ann Coulter says, we don't have time for an elegant person right now. The country's at stake. We need our brawlers and our fighters. And whether establishment conservatives like it or not, the culture war will be won by men like Steve Bannon and Donald Trump, who use straightforward language and who never apologize. One man who has long understood what Republicans need to do in order to win is Roger Stone, a legendary political operative known for pulling dirty tricks. He's been described as a henchman, hitman, and a master of the dark arts, all in the same article. Although he made his career in the Nixon administration, Stone has been backing anti-establishment figures for decades, including Reagan in 1976 and Trump in 2016. Stone knows how to pick a winner, and that's why he named me on his 2016 Best Dressed list. So it's clear the man has good taste in more than just political candidates. We all need our attention focused on conservative issues, not leftist ones. Stop following the agenda of the Daily Beast and the New York Times. Let the left worry about insignificant threats like Pepe the Frog and the six or so remaining Klansmen in America. We need to turn our attention to issues that the left either doesn't care about or doesn't want us to notice, like their domination of academia and pop culture. I'm sure I sound like a broken record at this point, but until we make serious progress on these fronts, everything else is just noise. Politics is more complicated than assembling facts and writing good arguments. It's a brutal battle for the attention of the public, and it always has been, even before the era of Donald Trump. That's why fabulous, irrepressible faggots are so original and compelling compared to the run-of-the-mill copycat leftist celebrities. And they're so perturbacious to the left. Much as it might irk debate club conservatives, politics today is showbiz, and if we want to win, there need to be more Milos. There's a blessing for the establishment here. By focusing attention on provocateurs, it gives breathing space for everyone else to develop their arguments and present them to the public without censure. After an encounter with a force of pure irreverence like me, a George Will column must seem like a nice break. A smart observer might realize that's the whole fucking point. In March of 2017, Charles Murray, renowned author of The Bell Curve, was violently pursued by an angry mob when he attempted to give a lecture at Middlebury College. I know, bitch stole my act. Perhaps you think I'm just a comedian doing all this for fun. Perhaps you think I'm just the world's biggest narcissist. And both these things are at least partly true. But I'm also deadly serious about the American right to speak freely on any topic. It's why I came to this country. People like Charles Murray deserve to have their voices heard. And my divinely appointed job is to toughen up kids so they can properly engage in the big debates. Daniel Henninger in the Wall Street Journal brilliantly quoted President Eisenhower. He said, quote, "Don't join the book burners. Don't think you're going to conceal thoughts by concealing the fact that they ever existed. Even if they think ideas that are contrary to ours, their right to say them, their right to record them, and their right to have them at places where they are accessible to others is unquestioned, or it isn't American." End quote. McCarthyism is what they called it in 1953. Now we just call it liberalism. What happened to Charles Murray is exactly why I do what I do, and it's exactly what I've been warning everyone was going to happen. And I'm telling you, it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better unless we fight back. The left wants to shut the Overton window and push conservatives out of public view altogether. Ironically, Republicans want to do something similar. Before I arrived on the scene, they were close to succeeding. Even consummate moderates like the libertarian columnist Kathy Young were being banned from campuses. That's how the left fights. They take control of culture and use it to smear even moderate conservatives as racists, sexists, and bigots. By the time American youths reach college age, significant portions of them are frothing at the mouth, desperate to suppress conservatism, which they believe to be synonymous with bigotry. When they reach that point, there's little hope of them listening to our arguments, no matter how strong they may be, and that's why this civil war has to end. Conservatism needs its great thinkers and its brilliant minds, the debate club brigade, to persuade voters who are already open-minded. But we also need provocateurs and, yes, even clowns, to grab the attention and challenge the biases of those who don't want to be challenged, or people who just don't realize what's going on out there. No movement has ever survived with just moderates and just intellectuals, and no movement has ever survived with just hellraisers. If we want to win, we need both. Chapter 9. Why Muslims Hate Me. I'd really hate to be thrown off a roof. In the summer of 2015, Europe opened its doors to millions of people who would very much like to do that to me, and probably to do it to you too. After a picture of a drowned Syrian boy went viral, globalist elites like Angela Merkel exploited sympathy to lower the drawbridge on an entire continent, welcoming millions of Muslim migrants and moving another step closer to eliminating national borders. The implicit message from the media was clear. all migrants are just like that poor young drowned boy. Innocents fleeing oppression, hunger and death in war-torn Syria. But in reality, fewer than half the people admitted to Europe in the months following were from Syria at all. Most weren't refugees either. They were economic migrants from regions of the world even more radical than the country that currently hosts the Islamic State. And they weren't boys. Globalist media and political elites sought to extend the rare moment of pro-migrant sentiment for as long as possible. Journalists flocked to German train stations to take pictures of teary-eyed liberals holding placards stating "Refugees welcome" and hugging the smirking new arrivals. Over 1 million Muslims poured into the Mediterranean to cross into Europe. Of course, it only took a few months for this leftist dream to turn into a nightmare. On New Year's Eve 2015, the new arrivals, together with Germany's pre-existing Turkish population, introduced Germany to Muslim misogyny. An estimated 2,000 Muslims, acting in gangs, unleashed Taharush Gamia, an Arab phrase meaning collective sexual harassment, on German women returning from New Year's celebrations. Attacks took place in the cities of Cologne, Hamburg, Frankfurt, Dortmund, Düsseldorf, and Stuttgart. By night's end, police estimated that at least 1,200 women had either been groped or sexually assaulted, including at least 5 full rapes. It was the worst night of sexual assaults in Germany since the Red Army's invasion. Germany wasn't alone. Sweden, which at that time had already welcomed more than 140,000 migrants, was also beset by sexual assault. A report from the Gatestone Institute referred to a summer inferno of sexual assault in Sweden. This was largely suppressed by the police and by the media. But analysing Swedish crime data, the report found a particular surge in group assaults on girls aged 14 to 15. Virtually all of the apprehended attackers were citizens of Afghanistan, Eritrea or Somalia, 3 of the 4 largest refugee groups in Sweden. Various cities, as well as others throughout Europe, began handing out flyers to incoming migrants, explaining why groping women and bashing gays isn't great. Thanks to Muslim immigration, Sweden now has rape statistics approaching what feminists in the US claim happens on American college campuses. But rape, unfortunately, was just the beginning. Next came murder. On March 22nd, 2016, 2 bombs exploded in Brussels airport, killing 13 people. An hour later, another explosion went off in the town of Melbeck, killing 20. The attack's mastermind, who also planned the November 2015 Paris attacks, was Abdelhamid Abaoud, a Belgian native who travelled to Syria to fight for the Islamic State before returning to Europe at some point during the refugee crisis. European states suspected of letting him pass through their borders on his return to Belgium immediately issued flustered denials. But the truth is, no one was looking that closely at the streams of migrants flooding across the continent's borders. Abaoud's attacks, encouraged by the Islamic State, inspired a string of copycat strikes in Europe's summer of terror. 1 month later, a police officer and his wife were stabbed in Magnanville, France, by Larossi Abala, acting on the orders of ISIS. 1 month after that, on Bastille Day, a Muslim driving a 19-ton truck ploughed through the Promenade des Anglais in Nice, France. 86 people were killed and more than 400 were injured. 2 weeks after Nice, Germany was hit by a stabbing in Würzburg and then, a week later, a suicide bombing in the town of Ansbach, both at the hands of Islamists. 2 days after Ansbach, 2 Islamic State terrorists stormed a Catholic church in Normandy, slitting the throat of an 86-year-old priest before French anti-terrorism police shot them both and rescued the remaining hostages. 10 days later, in Charleroi in Belgium, a man attacked police officers with a machete while shouting "Allahu Akbar," which translates, of course, to "Allah is the greatest." 1 month after that, 2 police officers in Molenbeek, Belgium, were stabbed by a migrant who was also shouting "Allahu Akbar." 3 more ISIS-motivated stabbings would take place in Europe before the year's end. Rimini in Italy, Scharbeek in Belgium, and Cologne in Germany. The United States faced its own terror attack in 2016 in Orlando, Florida. 49 people were killed and 53 wounded at Pulse, a gay nightclub. It was the deadliest attack on American soil since 9/11, and the deadliest act of homophobic hate in US history. I gave a speech outside Pulse about the threat posed to women and gays by Islam. The recording has been viewed millions of times across various platforms, but not a single cable or broadcast channel aired any of it. It's a uniquely American trait to rely on foreigners to take the true stock of American culture. I am here with a warning from Europe. If America opens its doors to Islamic migrants, as Europe has, Pulse will be just the start. Islam isn't like other religions. It's more inherently prescriptive and it's much more political. That's why I, a free speech fundamentalist, still support banning the burqa and restricting Islamic immigration. Walter Burns' famous essay, Flag Burning and Other Modes of Expression, makes the point that speech and actions are different. But he also reminds us that the founders were for unlimited speech on religious topics, but not on political principles, like advocating for tyranny. Everywhere Islam exists, you will find political tyranny. Islam is as much a political ideology as it is a religion, and that's why limits on it are perfectly compatible with religious freedom and the First Amendment. In electing Donald Trump, America may have saved itself. Naturally, he was attacked as a racist and a bigot throughout the campaign, both by Merkel-like establishment conservatives and by the American left, but such behavior shouldn't surprise us anymore, because the left has been selling out to Islam for years. During my college talks, I'm often asked what arguments to use when debating with the regressive left, and I always have the same answer. Use the example of Islam. There's nothing else which better exposes the modern left's rank hypocrisy, their disregard for the facts, and their hatred for the West and all it stands for, than their attitude to Islam. Every noble principle the left claims to uphold, and of course there are some, from rights for women to gay liberation and even the concept of diversity itself, die on the altar of its sycophantic defense of Islam. Karl Marx called religion the opium of the masses, and if you look at the left's attitude to Christianity, you might think they believe in this message. The progressive left's comedians and columnists never miss an opportunity to belittle and denigrate conservative Christians. And yet, they defend Islam at the expense of every other minority. Bill Maher, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, and Christopher Hitchens have all been frustrated by this question. Why does the left refuse to lift a finger against the most radical, dangerous, socially conservative, and oppressive religion on earth? Author Sam Harris sums up the backwards attitude of this group with his characteristic clarity. Quote, "These people are part of what Majid Nawaz has termed the regressive left, pseudo-liberals who are so blinded by identity politics that they reliably take the side of a backward mob over its victims. Rather than protect individual women, apostates, intellectuals, cartoonists, novelists, and true liberals from the intolerance of religious imbeciles, they protect theocrats from criticism." End quote. Of course, examples of this behavior aren't hard to find. Charlie Hebdo is a rare example of a leftist newspaper that understood radical Islam to be akin to the radical religious right. Actually, that's too mild. It's really closer to the radical medieval religious right. I know members of the radical Christian right in the United States, and they can occasionally be scary, but nowhere near as scary as Islamic terrorists who are more like Westboro Baptist Church members with machetes. Charlie Hebdo had the temerity to stand against religious bullies. They published humorous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, which made them prime targets of Al-Qaeda. Charlie Hebdo's editors correctly understood that allowing people to intimidate artists and writers by threatening violence was the first step on the road to a terrified, censored society. On January 7th, 2015, 12 employees of the newspaper paid for this with their lives when two armed Muslim siblings forced their way into Charlie Hebdo's offices in Paris and opened fire. Charlie Hebdo is a leftist publication. In fact, it's Marxist. Their opposition to Islam flowed from their opposition to the right. They're just as strident in their criticism of the National Front as they are of Islam. Now, I may happen to think the National Front deserves a more nuanced approach, but one could never accuse Charlie Hebdo of lacking consistency. They say they oppose bigotry, and they do, whether they perceive it in the European right or in Islam. So what did other leftists do when 12 of their comrades were gunned down by religious thugs? Did the old ideal of socialist solidarity finally kick in? Of course it didn't, as most of the civilized world adopted the slogan "Je suis Charlie." Before the month was out, a number of British student unions, including the University of Manchester, banned Charlie Hebdo under the safe space policies, arguing that it made Muslim students uncomfortable. What do you mean it made Muslim students uncomfortable? Apparently they think this is in the same league as making non-Muslim cartoonists dead. That, in a nutshell, is the modern progressive left for you. There was no collective display of solidarity from the left-wing literary class either. To an ordinary observer, the fact that the prestigious Penn Freedom of Expression Courage Award went to Charlie Hebdo in 2015 would not be particularly surprising news, much less a moral outrage, but 204 members of the organization, including established authors like Joyce Carol Oates, Laurie Moore, and Juno Diaz, thought so. They boycotted the awards, signing an open letter condemning Charlie Hebdo for making a marginalized community feel uncomfortable. They said, quote, to the section of the French population that is already marginalized, embattled, and victimized, a population that is shaped by the legacy of France's various colonial enterprises and that contains a large percentage of devout Muslims, Charlie Hebdo's cartoons of the Prophet must be seen as being intended to cause further humiliation and suffering, end quote. Ugh, what suffering, what horror. Cartoons published in a newspaper with a tiny circulation that Muslims don't have to buy if they don't want to. The author Salman Rushdie, who faced an Iran-backed fatwa for the crime of writing about a forbidden area of Islamic theology, summed up the stance that the boycotters had taken. The massacre of cartoonists, wrote Rushdie, was a, quote, hate crime, just as the anti-Semitic attacks sweeping Europe and almost entirely carried out by Muslims are hate crimes. This issue has nothing to do with an oppressed and disadvantaged minority. It has everything to do with the battle against fanatical Islam, which is highly organized, well-funded, and which seeks to terrify us all, Muslims as well as non-Muslims, into a cowed silence. These writers have made themselves the fellow travelers of that project. Now they will have the dubious satisfaction of watching Penn tear itself apart in public. End quote. The boycott, thank God, failed, and Charlie Hebdo got its award, presented to it by Neil Gaiman, who stepped in after other writers pulled out. You have to wonder how he must have felt to see so many of his peers in the left-wing literary establishment choose to attack murdered cartoonists rather than stand against the ideology that created their murderers. Embarrassed for the left, I hope. The reaction to the Charlie Hebdo shooting is just one example among many of the left's suicidal attitudes toward Islam. When Paris again fell victim to Islamic terrorism in November 2015, with over 100 slain in a series of attacks masterminded by the Islamic State, Salon published the following headline. We brought this on ourselves. After Paris, it's time to square our values with our history. The article blamed the West, behaving horrifically in the Middle East for decades, for the deaths in Paris. In March 2016, after Muslims killed 35 in Brussels, Salon allowed the same writer to run virtually the same article under the new headline, We brought this on ourselves, and we are the terrorists too. Liberals blaming the West for the terrorist attacks has become depressingly predictable after each new atrocity. What really cements the left's betrayal, though, of its own values over Islam isn't so much the opposition to wars in the Middle East, but its opposition to liberal Muslim reformers. And this is the stuff that should horrify you the most. The best example of this is Majid Nawaz, one of the few moderate Muslims making an effort to drag his religion kicking and screaming into the modern age. And for his work combating extremism, supporting interfaith tolerance, and challenging bigotry in the Muslim community, he is rewarded with polite silence from the left at best, and scornful disdain at worst. New heights of absurdity were scaled in 2016 when the Southern Poverty Law Center added Nawaz to a list of 15 anti-Muslim extremists. The entire list was ridiculous. It included women's rights activist Ayan Hirsi Ali and Islam critics Daniel Pipes, Pamela Geller, and even David Horowitz. But the addition of Nawaz, precisely the sort of moderate Muslim that anti-bigotry, anti-intolerance groups like the SPLC ought to be encouraging, summed up just how morally bankrupt the left's attitude to Islam has become. Is there, and perhaps this is just my gallows humour speaking, anything more amusing than a religion so thin-skinned that cartoons designed to provoke it give rise to deadly shootings as though precisely to prove the point of those cartoonists? Is there anything more preposterous than the phrase, the religion of peace? What an indictment of America's supposedly brave comedians that not a single one dares to tell a decent joke about Islam on primetime television. The left claims that it opposes bigotry, but Islam, the most bigoted ideology on the planet, is given free pass after free pass. Here are a few things that Muslims in Britain, who are often portrayed as one of the more integrated Western Muslim communities, believe. A Gallup poll of Muslims in the UK found that not a single Muslim in the 1,001 people polled thought that homosexuality was morally acceptable. Not one. The same poll found that 35% of French Muslims and 19% of German Muslims thought homosexuality was morally acceptable. And these polls were taken before Europe's importation of hordes of young Muslim refugees from Syria. As you know from the previous chapter, I have some sympathy for this point of view, even though leftists will pour scorn on me for saying so, while continuing to hypocritically pander to Muslims. And yet, here are more unsettling poll numbers specific to British Muslims from the left-wing broadcaster Channel 4. 52% believe homosexuality should be illegal. 23% would like to see Sharia law in England. 39% believe that a woman should always obey her husband. And 31% consider it acceptable for a man to have multiple wives. When it comes to Islamic immigration, assimilation doesn't seem to be an option. When in Rome, so goes the Islamic way, rape and kill everyone and then claim welfare. Andrew Bolt on Sky News Australia, whose show I go on regularly because they get the lighting just right, perfectly encapsulated Islam's integration problem in the West. He recalled the case of Dr. Ibrahim Abu Muhammad, the Grand Mufti of Australia, who gave a speech explaining to Australians that they're wrong to think Muslims can't integrate into Australian culture. There's just one problem. The Grand Mufti, one of the foremost Islamic scholars in Australia, delivered the speech in Arabic. He had lived in Australia for 19 years, and his integration speech was in Arabic. Now, that's what I call chutzpah. There were 1.6 billion Muslims in the world as of 2010, roughly 23% of the global population, according to a Pew Research Center estimate. But while Islam is currently the world's second largest religion after Christianity, it is the fastest growing one. The growth of Islam ought to be concerning for liberals. Here's a religion that sanctions forcing women into submission, a religion that sanctions the execution of gays, a religion that sanctions the killing of non-believers, and it's spreading quickly. Islam preys on the most vulnerable in society, offering them a sense of higher purpose. It's no wonder that Lindsay Lohan is thinking of converting. They also have especially high conversion rates in jails, making Islam and dick the two things most likely to penetrate new inmates. For years, the left has been tormenting the right with tales of bigotry. We're supposed to consider frat boys singing lewd songs about women as an example of rape culture. We're supposed to look at critics of Black Lives Matter as racists. And we're supposed to consider Christian bakeries uncomfortable with gay weddings as the leading example of homophobia in society today. Well, there is a real rape culture in the West, and there is real homophobia in the West, and there is real outgroup intolerance in the West, but it all comes from Islam. Never again let the left tell you that they are the ones fighting bigotry. They are in fact its greatest defenders. They are the ones standing in the way of Pamela Geller, Geert Wilders, Donald Trump, Nigel Farage, Douglas Murray, Majid Nawaz, Sam Harris, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and me. All the people who are actually doing something to fight the most intolerant, bigoted ideology in the world today face a constant pushback from the very same people who, if they were true to their own principles, would be on our side. But it doesn't matter, because with Daddy elected in the United States and Brexit underway in the United Kingdom, I'm confident we can win without the regressive left. Islam today is like communism in the early stages of the Cold War. They both present young, disaffected people with an idealistic, tribal, utopian vision that is drawing in millions. And like communism, Islam is inspiring violence all around the world. If there's one thing that we've learned from the battle with communism, it's that the West can't compromise its principles. It can't apologize for itself, as the left constantly wants us to do. It was no accident that the Berlin Wall collapsed at the end of the 1980s. It was the end of a decade when America, and to a lesser extent Britain, shook off the malaise of the 1970s and recovered their sense of self-confidence. Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan proudly walked the world stage, aggressively asserting the greatness and superiority of their respective nations. America first, you see, wasn't invented by Trump, only perfected. In the increasingly backward, increasingly poor Warsaw Pact, the choice between the West and communism quickly became a no-brainer. At the same time, Western governments poured money into programs designed to undermine the idea of communism. With state funding, Radio Free Europe and Voice of America ceaselessly broadcast the news of anti-communist activities, as well, critically, as jazz and rock music across the Iron Curtain. The propaganda campaign was so successful that KGB memos asserted that up to 80% of Soviet youth were listening to Western radio broadcasts. That's rather a long way from our current leaders' attitudes to Islam. Far from asserting the superiority of Western liberalism to the theocratic East, they're wearing headscarves, bowing to Saudi monarchs, and grinning stupidly in mosques. In the Cold War, some Western leaders advocated peaceful coexistence with the Soviet bloc. Sure, but I don't think any of them ever donned Mao suits or sang the Internationale. Instead of drawing attention to problems with the Islamic way of life, our leaders seek to present the increasing violence of the religion's followers as the actions of a tiny minority who will soon be defeated. But they won't be defeated. The Islamic State may be crumbling in Syria, but it represents a worldview that is attracting swathes of young people, because the West has done nothing to stand up for its own superior way of life. An entire generation of young Muslims are now coming to view muftis as their rock stars and mosques as their concert halls. Western leaders who talk about challenging the radicalization of young people then turn around and talk about how wonderful Islam is. The results are inevitable and devastating. It's theoretically possible to peacefully coexist with Muslims, but only if they can find a way to remove the radical element from contemporary Islam. Too many of the current generation are attracted to an ideology that insists on imposing its way of life on everyone else or killing us if we refuse. And the Muslims who don't actively identify with the most poisonous end of their ideology are perfectly happy to turn a blind eye to its horrors, as poll after poll has demonstrated. Like communism, we are dealing with a viral meme that needs to be fought head on. The old talking points about violent extremists are no longer working, and in fact, they never worked to begin with. The idea of Islam and Islamism, these two things are dissolving into one another, and we're fighting now an idea. The only way to beat that idea is to show that the West is the best. Western leaders need to talk about what makes our society great. Freedom, tolerance, equality of opportunity. Like Reagan and Thatcher and Trump and Farage, they need to tirelessly assert their own country's greatness. Islam has to be made uncool. This is a war of culture as much as it's a war of politics or faith, and we have to start fighting it in culture now. In music, books, journalism, art, and with every other means of creativity at our disposal, demonstrating as we do so what is possible with the free expression we so cherish in the West. But more than that, and this is what they really don't want to do, our leaders need to start talking about what makes Islamic societies bad. We have a massive hill to climb. When a terrorist bomb went off at Ariana Grande's concert in Manchester in the UK, I challenged her on Facebook to condemn radical Islam, to condemn the ideology that had murdered so many of her young fans. Not only did she not do so, but Facebook made me remove those posts. I had offended two classes of people that Facebook will defend at all costs: pop stars and Muslims. Last summer, I annoyingly had to resign myself to the fact that I could not lead a gay pride march through the gay district of Stockholm, as I'd been planning for some months. My security team informed me that the risks in Sweden to my safety were simply too great. By that time, I'd already been subject to a deluge of Arabic death threats and one bomb threat on Twitter, which promptly suspended me for a day for receiving death threats. I have little love for Western feminists and leftists, not least for their relentless denial of everyday realities. But at least their willful ignorance rarely comes with a body count, at least not directly. Indirectly in the form of immigration policies, of course, it certainly does. It's only Muslims who are so fanatically devoted to their 6th century delusions that they will murder anyone who dares to challenge them. Well, there's a little phrase that I like to say that Muslims had better be prepared to hear more often. Sorry, no offence. But it's true. With so much of the Western media determined to play the ostrich on Islam, don't be surprised when the public turn to people like Trump and to dangerous faggots to give them the real story. The gap between what liberals and some Muslims believe Islam to be and how it's actually practiced in many Islamic nations is so wide that it's hard to imagine any Islamic reformation taking place in the near future. But until it does, this is an ideology utterly incompatible with the West. Chapter 10. Why Gamers Don't Hate Me. In 2013, the left-leaning Guardian proudly proclaimed that the fourth wave of feminism was upon us, and that it was defined by technology, tools that are allowing women to build a strong, popular, reactive movement online. In other words, now women can bitch about their existence to millions of strangers on the internet rather than just crying while ironing like they were always supposed to. A good example is the Donglegate scandal, in which tech evangelist and ardent feminist Adria Richards overheard a couple of men making lewd jokes about dongles at a tech conference, tweeted a picture of the two men, and got one of them fired. When the internet reacted with outrage against Richards, Wired magazine cited the scandal as evidence of misogyny in tech culture rather than what it was: an insane overreaction cooked up by a professional malcontent and grievance monger. The existence of fourth wave feminism and its supposed reason for existing has created a chicken and egg type of conundrum. With so much of their activism linked to the internet, they unavoidably encounter dissent. Sometimes a great deal of it, considering how unpopular feminists are. The Yes All Women hashtag, intended to protest misogyny, was met with the parody Yes All Cats. Comment threads under notorious feminist provocateur Jessica Valenti's column regularly attract thousands of critical comments. Critics of feminism on YouTube began to attract just as many views as the feminists themselves in the last few years, while dissident communities like Reddit's Men's Rights Hub have ballooned in size. Upon seeing how many people disliked them, feminist activists started complaining that online harassment was giving them PTSD. They used politicians, activists, groups, and sympathetic media outlets to apply relentless pressure to social media companies, demanding that they clamp down on harassment, by which they mean people with opposing views. Any criticism of fourth-wave feminism has become known in the media as trolling, harassment, misogyny, or abuse. Anita Sarkeesian, once an unknown vlogger who whined about alleged sexism in video games with cherry-picked data, rose to prominence after she tapped into the trolling panic. After trolls from 4chan and other communities mocked her in 2012, posting rude comments underneath her YouTube videos and photoshopping her into porn, Sarkeesian attracted massive media attention. An online fundraising project for her series on women in video games soared past its targeted $6,000, ultimately receiving almost $160,000 in donations. Sarkeesian was invited to speak at the video game studio Bungie and to TEDx Women 2012. In 2013, game creator Zoe Quinn was having business problems. Her new game, a rudimentary point-and-click adventure called Depression Quest, needed thousands of votes from gamers to be greenlit for publication on the largest digital distributor of video games, Steam. Guess how she got that publicity? Quinn said she was being tormented by trolls from a little-known online community called WizardChan, a sort of 4chan clone populated largely by men with crippling social anxiety. She claimed they'd sent her harassing phone calls, of which there was no evidence. But still, articles appeared in the games press claiming that Quinn was facing, quote, extreme harassment because she's a woman, end quote. Less than a year later, transgender game developer Brianna Wu deliberately antagonized the Gamergate movement with a trolling campaign and used the resulting backlash to claim that she, too, was a victim of online harassment. Claiming to have fled her house because of anonymous death threats, she then did what any traumatized victim would do. She went on a media tour, talking to MSNBC, The Guardian, The Boston Globe, any other media outlet who'd listen to her. Previously a nobody, she's now running for Congress. Isn't it weird how these women and wannabe women all end up far better off after their trolling ordeals? Funny how that works. Feminists in gaming capitalized on the buzzwords and campaigns that had appeared in the fourth wave of feminism. Fake threats, trolling, and lewd remarks on the internet weren't just flippant jokes by teenagers. They contributed, said the feminists, to rape culture. Criticizing feminists for being too rude or obnoxious was tone policing. Feminists by 2014 had an entire arsenal of buzzwords to help them sideline, dissent, and paint any and all critics as bigots. No matter how legitimate the criticism, gaming journalists were committed to their narrative. It was feminist heroines versus evil misogynist trolls who just wanted to terrorize them. If a single troll from 4chan sent a single death threat to a feminist, and let's be clear, these threats were either hoaxes or simply people letting off steam on the internet, then that became the story, not the legitimate concerns of gamers. The only logical conclusion to the feminist-led campaign against online harassment was censorship. Unless a new hero could emerge, one with the power to stop this draconian crackdown on free speech. The Joker fell into a vat of chemicals, which drove him insane. Magneto was imprisoned in Auschwitz, where he saw the worst of human nature. And Dr. Doom decided to take over the world after a vision of the future revealed humanity destroying itself. I, too, have a supervillain origin story, and mine was Gamergate, a bitter war between gamers, anonymous internet trolls, hectoring feminist scolds, and left-wing journalists. If you only follow the mainstream media, you probably only know Gamergate as grown men playing video games all day and harassing women on the internet. In reality, it was the first battle in an anti-leftist, culturally libertarian, free speech movement that led directly to Trump's election. Let me tell you the real story, and this is probably the only version of this story in print, written by any journalist anywhere, that comes anywhere close to the facts. Gamergate, often considered a bewilderingly vast topic, is actually relatively simple. What happened was this. In early 2014, Nathan Grayson, a writer for a Gawker-run gaming blog, Kotaku, wrote favorably about a game called Depression Quest, for which he acted as a consultant without disclosing his involvement in the project. Grayson's connection to the game and his romantic relationship with its creator, Zoe Quinn, was discovered after an exposé from Aaron Joni, one of Quinn's ex-boyfriends. Upon reading Joni's story, gamers began to suspect that game developers and journalists were literally in bed with each other, and that this was a systemic problem across the gaming industry. It turned out, of course, that they were right. Now, I have some sympathy for Quinn and Grayson. What Grayson did wasn't ethical, but in normal circumstances, it wouldn't lead to a culture war cataclysm. The games press wasn't unlike any other sort of trade press. It was characterized by pathetically low journalistic standards, an ideologically homogenous atmosphere, cliquey politics, and innumerable overlapping conflicts of interest. But few people beyond journalism professors really care if a reporter is friends with, or even if he's fucking, one of his reporting subjects. Yet thanks to the dreadful professional track record of the games press and their appalling responses to gamers' concerns, it just happened to become a thing. Following the discovery of the Grayson-Quinn connection, gamers across the web embarked on one of the greatest acts of collective internet sleuthing in history. Virtually overnight, Gamergate discussions sprang up on some of the web's biggest communities, like the anonymous discussion forums 4chan and Reddit, and Gamergate began trending on Twitter. Gamers quickly uncovered a web of connections between games journalists and their reporting subjects. Games journalists had reported on their friends without disclosure, and in some cases had even donated money to games that they then later wrote about without telling their readers. Critical Distance, a hub of social justice-oriented games critics, repeatedly gave favorable coverage to multiple game creators who had given them monthly donations through the crowdfunding site Patreon. Gama Sutra editor-at-large Lee Alexander published dozens of articles lauding her personal friends. Multiple other journalists were found to have similarly dire track records, which are now catalogued at the Gamergate-created website deepfreeze.it. All of this was embarrassing for the games media, especially since hardcore gamers have an innate respect for fair play. But it was hardly an international scandal. The real reason Gamergate became a gigantic story was thanks to the reactions of these media outlets when they were exposed as ethically compromised. For Lee Alexander, there could be no quarter given to gamers. She wrote, "These obtuse shitslingers, these wailing hyper-consumers, these childish internet arguers. They are not my audience." In the space of 48 hours, a dozen articles were published in a similar vein, all op-eds, all repeating the same opinion. Gamers are bigoted white males trying to make the world of video games less inclusive. Arthur Chu at the Daily Beast called gamers misogynist losers who were making us all look bad. Kotaku's Luke Plunkett described them as reactionary holdouts that feel so threatened by gaming's widening horizons. Vice lamented that Aaron Joni's embarrassing relationship drama was killing the gamer identity. And the Daily Dot described Gamergate simply as a sexist crusade to destroy Zoe Quinn. At the same time, a discussion about the ethics of games journalism on Reddit's gaming subforum, one of the largest gathering places for gamers on the web, was completely nuked. Over 20,000 comments were deleted, making it one of the largest and perhaps the largest suppressions of discussion in Reddit's history. A site called NeoGAF, already known for its ban-happy owners, started kicking Gamergate supporters off the platform left, right, and center. Popular YouTuber Boogie2988 was banned just for taking a neutral stance on the topic. Even 4chan, known for hosting discussions about anything, no matter how vile, rolled out a blanket ban on Gamergate in mid-September. The decision sent shockwaves through its pro-free speech user base, leading to a mass exodus to alternative site 8chan. Fallout from the decision would eventually convince Christopher Moot Poole, the site's founder, to leave 4chan after 10 years at the helm. Gamergate wouldn't have got off the ground without a great deal of assistance from would-be censors. The very first YouTube video about the drama surrounding Aaron Joni and Zoe Quinn attracted a mere 4,599 views on its initial run. But Quinn lodged a false copyright claim against the video, taking it offline, and that's when the internet exploded. It's weird that someone like Quinn, who was so deeply embedded in web culture, would make such a mistake. After all, it was false copyright claims that propelled the rise of Anonymous, almost as though she had something to hide. Shortly after the games media launched its volley of articles smearing gamers as sexist, misogynist bigots, Gamergate surged in activity, and it would retain a high trending position for much of 2014 and well into 2015. By late 2014, it was apparent that Gamergate no longer described a scandal, but rather an entrenched consumer movement. Tens of thousands of gamers were prepared to wage war against a gaming media that had turned on them. Gamergate wasn't going to be a flash-in-the-pan controversy. It was here to stay. I entered the story in the early days of Gamergate when an anonymous Twitter account with an anime profile picture and the handle Libertarian Blue sent me a couple of tweets explaining the controversy. The account belonged to Alan Bukhari, now one of Breitbart's most gifted writers. He spoke of journalists engaging in nepotism and censorship, with critics being smeared as misogynists. I asked for more information. Out of our collaboration emerged my first story on the controversy, which was the first published story that unapologetically took the side of gamers. While the rest of the media lamented the alleged hate campaign against women in gaming, I took the ethics concerns of gamers seriously and listened with an open mind to their complaints about a partisan political press and an out-of-control feminist narrative that was slamming the lid on an open discussion in the games world. The headline I chose was understated as always, Feminist Bullies Tearing the Video Games Industry Apart. It turned heads, and it set the tone for later coverage. Having watched the online harassment panic grow to absurd heights, I was determined to show that criticizing and even mocking feminists didn't make you a misogynist. As for exposing the biases and ethical failings of the press, well, that was even more important. It was also trivially easy to accomplish, thanks to an anonymous source who is now one of my most trusted contacts in the industry. A month after the gamers and games journalists went to war, I was handed the most explosive story of the controversy, a series of leaks from something called Game Journo Pros, a secret email list used by journalists from gaming and tech publications including Kotaku, Polygon, Ars Technica, Rock Paper Shotgun, Wired, PC Gamer, and The Verge, in other words, everybody. I wasn't sure why I had been chosen to deliver these logs to the public, but I did know exactly what to do with them. Publish them all on Breitbart and watch as the flames of the greatest lulz fire on the internet leapt ever higher into the sky, because these logs confirmed gamers' worst suspicions about collusion behind the scenes in the gaming media. Journalists from competing outlets appeared to be in cahoots, making decisions about what to cover and how to cover it behind the backs of their readers. The games press was biased beyond belief. Kyle Orland, games editor of Ars Technica and the founder of the email list, was seen calling the concerns of gamers bullshit and encouraging other editors not to cover the Gamergate controversy at all and instead use social media to reproach gamers. An editor at one publication, Polygon, was seen urging the editor of another publication, The Escapist, to censor discussion of Gamergate on The Escapist's message boards. Orland was also seen encouraging other journalists to contribute to a fundraiser for Zoe Quinn, at which point Kotaku journalist Jason Schreier, to his credit, pointed out that a fundraising campaign for a game developer might not be the best idea at a time when games journalists were facing mass allegations of collusion and political bias. For gamers, the fact that such a thing had even been suggested by a games editor at a major tech publication said it all. There's no better feeling for a journalist than breaking a big story that other publications are afraid to touch, and I was already having a great time. But I was having an even greater time because I had at last discovered a corner of the internet to call my own. I had discovered web culture. Anonymity or pseudonymity instantly clued me in on why gamers were proving to be such tough adversaries for the biased progressive media and for the feminist architects of the new moral panic. The irreverence of 4chan was the product of an anonymous online environment which minimized the usual social consequences associated with taboo-defying speech. Progressives and feminists, the modern-day guardians of social mores, think that this is terrible. Leftist actor Will Wheaton has even suggested banning anonymity in online video games. Shortly after I began my reporting on Gamergate, I took a trip to the video games board of 4chan, known as Slash V, then one of the hubs of the movement, and I was met with what I would later discover were called memes and shitposting. Virtually everyone told at least one gay joke. My face was photoshopped onto a picture of the interracial gay porn movie Poor Little White Guy, and another 4chaner posted an image proclaiming that I was not simply a faggot, but a cool faggot like Freddie Mercury. Having spent my professional career in the stultifying, politically correct world of tech journalism, I was amazed and overjoyed to discover that there was still one place of pure, unfiltered mirth in the world. In other words, I'd found my people. If I were a disingenuous left-wing blogger, I could have painted my anonymous hosts on 4chan as the vilest of homophobes and bigots, but that wouldn't have been true, would it? It was obvious on its face that the people talking to me were not bigots of any kind, just irreverent teenagers with a healthy disregard for language codes. This was their way of showing affection, not disdain. Furthermore, the Gamergate supporters who came from V and its more politically incorrect sibling, Pol, didn't even meet the standard progressive definition of bigots. From the pages of The Guardian, Jessica Valenti, with no evidence whatsoever, denounced Gamergate as a last grasp at cultural dominance by angry white men. It was a glorious moment watching leftists on social media accuse Twitter users of being white dudes, only to see them dumbfounded as users responded with face pics clearly identifying themselves as women and minorities. As Gamergate gathered steam, thousands of female, gay, and ethnic minority gamers tweeted #NotYourShield to protest at having their identities used as shields to deflect the racially obsessed lies of rubes like Valenti. The first reaction of the game's media was disbelief. Rabid social justice warriors considered #NotYourShield to be full of ill-informed women, with no purpose other than shutting down talk about racism. A piece in Ars Technica, perhaps the most brazen report of the entire controversy, claimed that the accounts posting under the #NotYourShield hashtag on Twitter were just sock puppets and not genuine minorities. Other left-wing journalists made similarly disparaging comments, or more commonly, simply ignored the tag entirely, pretending instead that Gamergate was just a straight white male uprising. If all this sounds familiar, consider the apoplectic response from feminists and mainstream media journalists to Donald Trump's success with female voters.